Good morning.
Will you all be able to hear me if I speak in this tone? Does that work?
Great.
Good. Thank you for an amazing introduction. I'll try to live up to it now in the next few minutes. I'm grateful to be here, particularly because I've enjoyed conversations with folks at Westminster Presbyterian Church because you all think deeply. You take seriously the work of God in Christ. You think about how the church is engaged in mission. And so you've invited me for a two-part series this Sunday, today, and then next Sunday, the 13th. And so I thought I'd divide it. Today we'll talk about the problem, and next Sunday we'll talk about the solutions. So you all are the folks who are going to get the gist of kind of what's the scale of the problem. And I describe it as a crisis in mission. We're going to talk some about the changes that have occurred, not only in this country, but around the world. And it's made it so that we're facing what I believe for the U.S. church is the biggest crisis we've faced in the last 200 years. And I want to describe that if I could. So let's begin together. I'd like us to think about a concept called the flattening world. You've probably read about it. The world is flat, right? This is the bridge in northern Honduras, the bridge called Cholocanas. Now, don't laugh at my bridge. It's one of only four bridges that was left standing after Hurricane Mitch rolled through that Central American country. So it was well constructed. What's the problem with my bridge, though?
River.
All right. The context around it changed, and suddenly it right? Yeah, the context changed, but there's that bridge faithfully standing where it's always stood. So do we know any Presbyterian congregations or presbyteries or general assemblies, something like that? The neighborhood around them changed, the world changes, and there we are standing faithfully, and yet the purpose for which we were created no longer works. That image is a haunting image for me, but it says so much about so many of our churches and church structures, not the Church of Jesus Christ, but the structures that we've created to be faithful. So now we have young people who every week come to this church, come into worship, come into fellowship, talk with you, and their perception, and I'm told this by studies the Pew Research has done, millennials' experience of organized churches is that people want us to, the millennials say, the church wants us to join the choir, pay a tithe, and join a committee. And that doesn't speak to them. They want to change the world. And so we have a basic disconnect between in our generational language, and this is with kids from our own ethnicity, from our own, you know, they speak English like we do, and yet a very different form with different values. So I'd like to suggest that we need to be sensitive to these structures of missions, how we engage in God's mission. The form becomes very important because the world has changed so quickly. Let's think about it. I'm going to give a couple of examples. If you think about, how many of you grew up with the World Book Encyclopedia is what we had in my house. Encyclopedia Britannica some had. If you had a little more money, maybe. I don't know. I think that was more expensive in those days. But what a great system. You've got world experts. Tom knows more than anybody in the world about aeronautics. And so we'll get him to write that article. And we move around and we get the experts to write it. So it's a centralized structure. A group of elites or experts writes the information. And then World Book or Encyclopedia Britannica diffuse the information out to the masses. Right? Now, if we fast forward, think about Wikipedia. Holy cow, it's decentralized, it's a flat world. Anybody, you can write an article about anything you want. And it's peer-reviewed by a complex process, and some say it's not perfect process, because the quality of some of the articles isn't what they want. But by and large, Wikipedia is increasingly an authority on many, many topics, and it helps us to quickly access information. And yet, it's a completely flat system. Any of us can write those articles. Think of also, how many of you on the left, you recall the triptychs? Anybody go to the AAA and get a triptych? Oh my gosh, I say that in classes now, no hand goes up. Students have no idea what triptychs are, so I have to explain what that is. But again, we went to the elites. They knew the best way. If you want to go from Dallas to Albuquerque, here's the road you need to be on in northeast New Mexico. This is the line. Nowadays, Waze, how many of you are familiar with the travel app Waze? Well, what a great way. You can tell because if three of you are on that same highway that I am, you're relaying information up by saying, oh, there's a policeman that I just passed. You just push a button. You shouldn't be texting and driving. I don't know how this works exactly, but Waze depends on it. So that you're uploading information, and the system then, the computer receives it, and it lets you know, oh, there's a policeman just three blocks ahead. So you slow down suddenly. There's a fascinating thing. But what this has done is it's flattened the world, basically, in terms of travel. The same thing we could say about Yellow Cab, which had a centralized system. And now Uber is a much flatter system. In fact, I think they're still in litigation, but they don't call the people who drive their employees. They say they're, I can't remember the word, they're not clients.
Contractors,
there you go. They have a contractual relationship. So all of this is evidence of the flattening of the world. So think about your walk of life, your profession, your space in the world. How do you perceive that the landscape of your world has flattened? Do you see that? If you're a journalist, you know that journalism has turned upside down in the last 40 years. You may have worked for a well-known Pittsburgh paper that may be hanging by a shoestring right now. They don't know that they'll be able to make it in the next 3 years financially because people aren't buying papers. People are going to a very flat news network system where you can get information on the internet in a flash, right? Anybody else? Someone in a profession that's been turned upside down by this flattening of the world?
When I started at MIT, the web didn't exist, the World Wide Web.
Wow.
I was in that job and it was invented.
Yeah, yeah. And so it all is about the technology, the hardware, and now it's about everything else, really. Yeah, the communication. Right. Right. Yeah, you can deposit, you can take out money, everything you don't need to go into the bank itself.
You have everything on your phone. I can check everything I need. Right. I never pay bills on. Everything is very, very different.
It's frighteningly easy, isn't it? Please. Right. Yeah. So the world has flattened considerably now. The quality of that, of the ethical counsel they get may be questionable. And you have to know how to...
Thank you.
Yeah. You have to know how to discern, right? There's that step. So it sets us up for snowballing information. And the more extreme the information is, the greater play it will get on the internet, more clicks, more revenue for advertisers.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and I believe culturally that almost a cynicism, a lack of faith in expertise. I believe it's joining what there's been a traditional anti-intellectualism in U.S. culture, and I wonder if it's not fanning those flames again, because I see that even politically and socially in the U.S. these days. Okay. That's what the question I wanted to raise for us is, with that flattening, we're going to be thinking specifically about the church and the church as it engages in mission. But I want us to bear in mind that flattening situation. Okay, if we go back to 1912, anybody know what happened? There was a huge event held in Edinburgh, Scotland, called the Edinburgh Missionary Conference. It gathered more than 4,000 delegates. In the Free Church, which was a Free Church Assembly Hall in Edinburgh. This was the high point in the European missionary movement. It set beautifully idealistic goals to evangelize the world in this generation. That's where that call first was issued. There was a sense of imminent world change. There was an opportunity for the Church of Jesus Christ to move into all the world. Now, there's some challenges to this. There were relatively few women who attended this conference. Not many women were invited. There were only six representatives from what we would call the Global South. because Africa was in terms of the Christian presence, there was much many fewer Christians in Africa at that time, in Asia, etc. So it was basically folks who looked like me, white male, who gathered together from Great Britain, Europe, the continental Europe, and the United States. So they gathered together. That's kind of a picture for me of that mission coordinated by the elite. That changes. This is what came from that. The sailing ship that carried missionaries into all the world. People went from the United States, from Europe, into the Middle East, into Asia, South and East Asia, Latin America, and Africa. So this is a time, I'm just trying to illustrate this in church terms, in terms of the church's mission. This was what we would call the kind of a hierarchical. We sent professionals. Missionaries went as professionals. They were trained. They had language and culture studies. We went from that very centralized authority structure to this. This was, for me, it would be a picture of mission today. Everybody's got their boat in the water. Everyone engages in mission. In fact, young people today are starting nonprofit organizations to engage in mission like crazy. It's amazing the number of new mission structures that are being formed in these days. Well, what's the positive side of this? What's good about this? Anybody? What's a good feature of this? This.
Lots of new, great, innovative type of thinking and ideas.
Very much so. Very much so. So a lot of innovation, new ideas, new people are flooding in. Suddenly there are many more innovators. It's not just 4,000 white males like me gathered in a dusty hall in Edinburgh, but rather every John and Jane Q. Presbyterian and Catholic and Protestant can join into God's mission. That's great. Yeah, Bob.
When you're describing the situation in Edinburgh and how it's prepared for missionary work, it occurs to me that encourages a kind of paternalism that you might not get if people weren't given so much focus and energy and training and all that stuff. It tends to put them on a little bit of a pinnacle.
I think you're really right, and you're touching on something, Bob, that's important we'll think about together next week also, is when you have a flattening world, it allows for more mutual relationships suddenly. Because when I was sent by the Presbyterian Church USA, Ruth and I, my wife and I, went to the Congo, and I had, let me tell you, the degrees I had behind my name, the language study I had done, you know, I was prepared to go to do that thing. And so that put me into the people received me as saying, okay, this guy's an expert. And they treated me as such. And so there was that sense of a bit of a hierarchy in that, plus the colonial model that came historically behind us. And so that I think that set us up for that more hierarchical relationship. Nowadays, we just get off the plane and give somebody a hug. So there's a beauty in that. There's also some challenges. What would be the challenges of a flat system?
Mm-hmm. New wine and old wineskins. The problem is not the new wine. The problem is the old wineskins.
Say a word about that. What's the problem with our wineskin?
The problem with the old wineskins is that the new content breaks the old form. Mm. And the old form resists it.
That's right. That's right. And we're seeing many mission agencies. Yeah, the comment was, it's like the new wine in old wineskins. We've got new wine that's poured in from these new innovators. The challenge is that the old structures can't hold them. And so we see, I mean, I was part of, I worked for the Presbyterian Church, our mission agency, for 30 years, and the last 10 years as director. And to see the stress on people and structures, and what do you do with these rules that no longer apply? We really struggled with that. How do we, the rules of fundraising, how do we fund mission changed radically in those 10 years. The first day I walked in on the job in 2007, we had been 10 years in Peru, got back, I walked into work, and there was a fundraising letter. And I was supposed to sign it. We were going to send it out to, it was like, I don't know how many, several thousand people. And I was like, oh my gosh, Presbyterian World Mission has never sent out a fundraising letter. We went through the presbyteries, that went to the congregations, that went to the people. And now all of a sudden we flatten the world. We're jumping over presbytery execs. Don't do that in a Presbyterian system, friends. We're jumping over presbytery execs and pastors. And that's like playing with fire in the Presbyterian church. So we ran into a lot of pushback because it was an innovation. But what I'm trying to suggest in this is there's been a significant flattening even in our mission structures. And so I was watching those old wineskins be shredded by the new wine. What are some downsides to having this flattened world when everybody's got their boat in the water in terms of engaging in mission? What are some potential problems with that model? We've talked about the good, new innovation, new ideas, more representative, it draws a lot more people in. Right, yeah. And so that same question that we're asking about Wikipedia, the quality. What if we have a sense, many people who are engaged in mission say, you know what, I think we're repeating the same mistakes that we made 100 years ago. You all recall the situation in China mission history where American missionaries realized at first they were giving a bag of rice to hungry Chinese Christians. People joined the faith and they'd give them some rice. And then they realized they were creating, there was a whole term there, rice Christians. People started coming to church to get rice. Well, that's not a good way to grow your church. You grow your church, but then you know people go to the next whoever has more rice to give. And so they realized that. But many of our current folks who are engaged in mission, churches that are engaging in mission, don't know that concept. And so they can quickly repeat the mistakes of the past. Any other challenges with this model? Please.
It's very hard to say what is the truth these days. There's a lot of misinformation, and some people blame others for misinformation, and they blame others for misinformation, so we don't have criteria to determine what really information is accurate. So if you flatten it out, it's a mixture of misinformation and information, and in our educational system, we don't teach people to think.
Yeah.
To be discriminating, and so it's a problem.
Yeah, and so quality can really suffer. And I think also we've talked about the internet's tendency to polarize. The innovations that are more extreme get more play, get more clicks, and more people are engaged in that. Another challenge to this, I think one of the beauties of our foreparents, our forefathers, basically, back in the Edinburgh conference, is they took very seriously communicating together, collaboration, consultation. They did some things that we wouldn't agree with 100%, but they literally divided up the world. When Ruth and I were sent to Congo in 1981, there are two provinces where only the Presbyterians work. And that way, all the Presbyterian missionaries, we all learned Chiluba language. That was the language spoken. And so today, there's 2 million Congolese Presbyterians that live in that region. It's amazing. But if we had to go and learn, Chiluba for this area, and then the Methodist area was Swahili, and then the American Baptists and British Baptists work in the Kikongo-speaking area, you can imagine it would have been very difficult to support a mission in a country as large as the Democratic Republic of Congo. So there was a sense of strategizing that happened in very helpful ways that we saw in Edinburgh, even though it took them a month to communicate, send a letter over to Britain and for the letter to come back, it took a long time. Now we can be in touch instantaneously, but we often don't do that because we don't have that same collaborative spirit that our foreparents did. Well, I want to point to this major reality. I think this is one of the most under-researched but impactful realities in terms of changes that have happened. And that's this. When I ask the question, who is it that makes decisions in mission? Who allocates funding? Who allocates personnel? Decides where to send people? It's people who look like this. It's people who look like you. It's people who sit in congregations, who engage through committee work, and they're the primary decision makers now. In the Presbyterian Church, about 70%, let's see if I have about 85%, sorry, 85% are unpaid. They don't do this for a living. They haven't been trained for it. They didn't go to school for it. They're not going to special conferences to be trained in it. But they're members of mission committees. They're elders. In a small congregation, you might get a mission elder. The elder, a person on session, who has particular responsibility for local and global mission. In the Presbyterian Church, I did a study back in 2014 of 735 congregational mission leaders in the Presbyterian Church USA. And 85% of them did not receive a salary for that. They were doing it part-time. They just did it, you know, Saturday night after they finished their chores, and then they'd put that together before they'd have their meeting on Sunday morning. Well, this is a major change. This is also a factor. Only about 6% of those people participated in what we call a missiological conference, some kind of a conference to help them think more deeply or study more deeply about mission. So we've got a pretty major disconnect. That is, in the last year, have you attended some kind of a missiological conference, that is the study of mission, not just a mission fair where you're seeing the products of mission. About 94% had not. And likewise, about 92% had read either no books, one or two books on mission. What I'm trying to point to with these statistics, these are the three, Evangelical Missions Quarterly, International Bulletin, and Missiology are the three most well-known journals in mission studies. And about 84% of our folks hadn't read any article on missiology. What am I pointing to with that? It's not to describe that they're unprepared, but that there's a real disconnect between, you know, you've got all these people studying mission, but they're not feeding into who's doing mission. Well, that's a concern, I would argue. Okay, that's one. I've talked about the flattening of the world. I also want to mention some cultural changes that are going on in U.S. culture. These are documented. There's a book by two Dutchmen and a Bulgarian, Hofstede and Minkov, who put this together, and they're looking at about 82 cultures throughout the world. And they're describing cultures in national units. So this will probably primarily be white, what we call dominant culture in the United States. It's not really taking into account the particularities of subcultures within the U.S. context. But as we look at that, U.S. culture tends to be individualistic, and we're getting more individualistic. Hofstede and Minkov found that we were, in fact, the most individualistic country in the world in terms of our cultural background. And so that those primary values of freedom, that is, no one can tell me what to do, that's pretty important for us in our national culture. We have what's called a low power distance. We understand each other to be, if you have a bad teacher, professor, if you have there's someone who doesn't give you good service, you believe you have the right to say something about it. So it's more of a horizontal relationship. We don't think of our society as very hierarchical. We're very risk tolerant. We reward entrepreneurs. If you're an investment banker, you get paid better than someone who has a lower risk position. Likewise, we have a short-term focus, and different from our grandparents who invested more in education and saved more, we save less and invest less in education. And so that's a sense, Minkov and Hofstede were saying, we're becoming more short-term. We're more concerned about today and satisfaction of today's needs rather than being concerned for our kids and grandkids' needs. Second to last, the explicit communication in U.S. culture, similar to German culture and some other places, we say what we mean. People sometimes, we can bowl them over sometimes because we just, if we think that exists, we say it. In other cultural traditions, there's a lot of concern for the loss of face. You've heard that used in East Asian contexts. People will oftentimes, and my wife's from the northern part of the U.S. She comes from northern Indiana. I'm from Texas. And Southerners engage in what we call more indirect speech. And so I'll kind of go around the bush a couple of times before I'll actually say what I don't want to say something bad about someone. So I just say, well, you know, I don't know. It wasn't exactly the sermon that I would have preached. Or, you know, I say, and she said, well, that was a lousy sermon. And I'm like, no, you can't say that. So already you sense that difference. She's a bit more explicit communication, direct communicator, and I'm a bit more indirect. You see that particularly if you've traveled overseas, and you realize you understand the words that the person from the other culture is saying, but it's so indirect you have no idea what they're saying. You get the words, you know the vocabulary, but you don't know the meaning. Well, that's part of that direct and indirect communication, yes. Maybe so. Their assessment of that is based on savings and there's one other they had in that. So they're looking at specific indicators, to figure that out. But I'd be interested to know. Finally, there's a focus on doing over being. You all sense this even as you're planning a short-term mission trip. If you want to sell a short-term mission trip, don't tell your folks, we're going to go be with these folks in Haiti. No. You say, we're going to go build something. We're going to go do something. Because there's a real draw. We like to perceive ourselves as making a difference in the world, doing something, rather than being in relationship with. You'll find in a lot of other cultures in the world, that Africa, in indigenous contexts, in the Latin America in particular, and in East Asia, that there's a primary value on being in relationship with rather than doing. And so there's some significant differences. These cultural particularities, I'd say, that seem to characterize the way that a lot of us in the U.S. Live, to play on the movie, it's a bit the perfect storm. In a sense, you get good-hearted folks like us engaging with folks who don't say what they mean. We're risk tolerant. We say, oh, we can try this. We go into their community, we think, here's a great idea, you all should try this. Well, this may be a very risk intolerant group of folks. Quechua speakers, indigenous folks in Latin America are very risk intolerant because they've held on to their traditions for years and that's what's allowed them to survive. They're not about to try a new crop because you tell them to. You know, they resisted. To this day, folks in Quechua-speaking areas in Peru, in the highlands of Peru, plant their corn crops straight down the hill parallel lines going down. Well, rain falls and it washes a lot of that soil away. Agricultural extension agents from years back, goes back to the 1930s in the U.S., taught folks to do it horizontally against so that you don't have so much erosion. But this is how it's been done in the highlands of Peru, and it'll take an act of God to change that. It's very difficult to shift primary cultural understandings like how you plant corn, how you provide for your kids' needs. So what I'm trying to suggest is when we come into relationship with folks who have a very different orientation to life, it's a bit of a perfect storm. We may, in fact, bluster into the conversation, propose some ideas, folks kind of give you this nod, okay, and then you engage the project, and afterwards you think, that didn't go so well. What was that all about? I thought they wanted to do this. And it's amazing. Bala Kalep and I at the World Mission Initiative at Pittsburgh Seminary, most of our calls from congregations come when they reach this moment. They say, we're trying to evaluate this program, and we realize this didn't go as we had hoped. In fact, nothing that we wanted to accomplish were we able to accomplish. Kids came to the Vacation Bible School, but it was us doing everything. There was no sense of any skin in the game or participation by the local community. How can we address this? So that becomes a major concern to folks. I would argue that the crisis that we're facing is what I'd call selfie mission. Increasingly, when people talk about the reasons that they're engaged in mission, the purpose of God's mission in the world, people talk in terms of personal transformation, what mission does for me. Now, if our grandparents were sitting in the circle, they would be tapping their foot and getting uncomfortable, and finally they'd break into the conversation and say, wait, mission's not about us, about what we do for our churches. It brings young people into our churches. It gets people out into the world. It helps people to see new models. No, it's us giving our lives for the salvation of the world, for that betterment, for the abundant life that Christ promises. That's what it's about. So mission is, by definition, it's other-centered. It's serving the other. We become a servant to our neighbor. And yet, I was in the... I'm a frequent attender of the New Wilmington Mission Conference. And back in the 90s, I did a presentation on short-term mission and gave the presentation by beginning, and I began it with this. I said, what's the purpose of short-term mission? And we had, I mean, everybody flooded to the mic. We must have had 10 or 12 people come to the microphone because they all wanted to share. It has transformed the way we understand Christian faith. It's made me a better Christian. They shared all the different, each speaker said how much it had transformed their local congregation. And then a young woman, she was probably at that time about 18, she's now a student at Pittsburgh Seminary. I was thrilled to see her come to the seminary. But she was 18 at the time, and she got up and she was visibly upset. Her parents were missionaries, and so I think she had a different take on mission. She got up to the microphone, she goes, I've come to this conference every year of my life. She goes, what is it with us? We talk about mission as if it's all about us. When you told me, you've taught me all these years, that mission is to give our lives for others. And so one of the things that Hofstede and Minkow didn't look at in their study, but a factor that we see increasingly in the U.S., and there's some other studies that have been done about it, is looking at what they call the epidemic of narcissism in our culture, where we're very concerned about how things affect us, our rights, our concerns, our needs, and less concern for the needs of others. That's a characteristic in our culture that we need to be aware of. Well, what does that do to the way that we engage in God's mission? I would argue that it pushes us towards charity. It pushes us towards the ability to put something in someone's hands and see them immediately light up and thank us. That just feels so good. And so we've developed a whole culture, if you will, of orphan care, where we have groups of young people who will go to an orphanage, perhaps Haiti, perhaps the Dominican Republic, Mexico. We've created a whole industry. Do you know that there are more orphanages today than there were 20 years ago, even though not a single orphanage has been built in North America or Europe during that period? Well, why is that? The number of orphanages in the two-thirds world, in the global south, is exploding because many of our service teams go and they really want to go to an orphanage. So in a sense, in this bizarre economy, we're creating a demand for orphanages. So suddenly you have an entrepreneurial individual in Haiti who gathers children in the area. They may have one or two parents, but they bring them in to be housed and they're better fed because of the funds that they receive from the groups like ours who travel to be with them. And holding the baby for a couple of days over a short-term mission trip is so deeply satisfying to us that we start to create our trips around that. And you'll find many congregations organize their short-term mission trips around visits to orphanages. Well, this is curious, and I think both some folks in the younger generation, but particularly our grandparents, would be raising their hands and asking some very critical questions of the way that we're engaging in mission now. Did you have something? Okay. All right. It also pushes us to less evangelism and less justice work, because both of those take a little more time. You need a human relationship to be able to engage in how God works in the person's life that you're talking with. Evangelism is we understand that to be a longer term relationship. Likewise, justice work, you need to know a lot about context. You need deep knowledge of a particular context. You can't just go in and do a particular work for justice. So these require a bit more time. But we're pushed into short-term mission. That's about 80 or 85% of what we do nowadays is very short-term work. So I think this gives us a major challenge. You all know some of these books. Maybe you've heard of some of them, Toxic Charity or When Helping Hurts and other books. They're starting to come on the market because many people like us are starting to ask more critical questions, trying to understand, well, why are so many of our mission projects going into areas that aren't helping people as much as we would like? And so I highly recommend these four books. We've used that Doing Good Says Who with the Western Branch of Pittsburgh Presbytery. Some of you in this group were in there for those four sessions that we did last year. I'd like to think, if we could, about some of these. Child sponsorship, for example. At least one of the U.S. child sponsorship groups keeps about 88 cents on the dollar. And so, in other words, you give a dollar and 88 cents stays in this country, and so only 12 cents is going overseas, and of that they have to pay some of their infrastructure costs, employees and property, etc. And so a lot less of that gets to the child. Well, any business person would look at this model and say, what the heck is going on here? This doesn't make sense. When you talk to child sponsorship professionals, they say, it's the only, and I've got a quote in the book I'm working on, it's the only way to get the attention of the donor, say a number of the groups. It's the only way this to provide that person-to-person relationship with a child, yeah.
Photos like that show up in ads all the time.
Yeah.
A whole bunch of
them. Right. Right. Now, a number, World Vision and some of the other groups have done a very helpful thing, an admirable move. They put in fine print at the bottom that the funds that you give will help an entire community, not exclusively that child that you're supporting. And so in terms of development, that's a help. It helps to, you can't do a water project for one child, right? You can only give the child a backpack and some nutrition supplements, etc. So this is a good move that some have made, but still we're facing a situation where up to 88 cents on the dollar can be retained in this country. A very inefficient system. It's an inefficient kind of a program. You have to pay translators who are translating all those letters that you and I write to our kids and take us when we go visit the place. Who's going to accompany us to their community? All that takes staffing and is a very big expense. So that's a challenge, I think, with child sponsorship. Likewise, perhaps you've been in big on college campuses today is the meal packaging. So you package a quantity of rice or beans or lentils or different kinds of foodstuffs. Well, prepared meal packaging projects have exploded in popularity. They were hardly known 30 years ago, 25 years ago. But since 2005, just the largest of these of the organizations that does this has mobilized 350,000 volunteers to do meal packaging. And this is, I mean, every college campus you've ever heard of is doing it. Mission conferences do it. Congregations will do it. So a lot of folks do it. The question that I'd raise, and again, this is not a criticism of any congregation or college, but the question is, when a packaged meal can save a life when it's delivered to a disaster zone, but if you drop in free food into a community where food is a challenge, but there are people who are producing food, commodity prices drop because free food's flowing in, and you find that farmers start to leave the market. They can't make a profit. It doesn't pay them, and so they leave. And so you're creating a hunger problem for next year. So we've seen, particularly in places like Haiti and the Dominican Republic, where there's a lot of free food flowing, that we're creating a situation that is not helping farmers, and then they leave the market, and suddenly you don't have corn producers in these countries. That's a major challenge for us. The final example I give is in orphan care. I mentioned that. It's a kind of mission that responds to our needs to help a child, touch a child, hold a child, care for a child, express God's love to a child. But the challenges, even in terms of attachment disorders, if you have a different group of expatriates coming in to hold children every week over the summertime, which is typical for some of these orphanages, you can imagine the attachment disorder concerns that are raised by community mental health professionals in those places. So I'm painting the challenge to the structure question. That is, in this, we had this new wine pouring in with many people with good faith, with a deep commitment to engage in God's mission, but looking for the structures of mission to be able to help us be faithful in mission. Dr. Martin Luther King said this, and I think it's helpful, a helpful reminder. Philanthropy is commendable, but it must not cause the philanthropist to overlook the circumstances of economic injustice which make philanthropy necessary. That is to say, we're so focusing on the symptoms of poverty, we may not be asking the deeper question, which is what's causing poverty in this community? I think that's a really fruitful conversation for the body of Christ to have together. To look together, can we take a moment? Let's sit together. Maybe it's going to be longer than merely just an afternoon conversation when we come in and we hold the kids and we move on. This may be several days. We may need to spend some time getting to know each other. But if we could look together at the analysis of the causes of poverty, what's keeping people down in this community? And is there one thing, one barrier that we together could remove that's keeping people from the abundant life that Jesus Christ promises them? What would that be? That becomes a very powerful conversation. You get lots of people in the community who want to be in that conversation. It's also interesting to me, and particularly among millennials and younger folks in the churches in the U.S., this is precisely what they're interested in. And so as you frame a mission trip and help people both in the host community and in your travelers to begin to address these deeper issues, you find that the younger people are much more interested in this kind of a mission that's actually going to change the life on the long term for people. And I think that's a real helpful thing. I've got a couple of questions, but I want to point to the work that we're going to be doing together next week. The book that Bala Kalep and I are working on is called Three Stones Make Home, and it's refers to a Chiluba language proverb from South Central Democratic Republic of Congo. On cooking fires around the world, you know that it takes three stones. The geometrist among us would say three stones determine a plane, right? To get a flat plane, you need three points. Well, in cooking fires around the two-thirds world at least, it's generally a three-stone fire that makes the hearth of the home. And so in a very real sense, in Congolese cultures across the Democratic Republic of Congo, those three stones make the home. That's where the family gathers. That's where values are transmitted. That's how you learn to become a good person, an honorable person, is through your participation in the family conversations that go around the hearth. We're using that as an image, and we'll suggest three parts, if you will, that we believe we need to work on as U.S. Christians engaged in mission. We'll look at mission as companionship. What does it look like to understand mission as our walking down the road together, like on the road to Emmaus, perhaps, is a biblical suggestion, where we're walking together with our global partners and also with Jesus Christ. One of the criticisms that global partners have of our engagement in mission is they say, you all are very secular. You don't pray with us. You don't share with us your testimony. We'd love to hear what God is doing in your life. Oftentimes we go and we say, okay, we're going to package meals, or we're going to do a vacation Bible school, or we're going to do this and that. But we don't allow for time where we can share, this is what God is doing in my life. What's God doing in your life? What a beautiful invitation to hear how God is changing that person even as you share your own testimony. In the Presbyterian Church, we don't do a whole lot with testimonies, do we? In most Sunday worship services, you don't hear much testimony. But our global partners consistently say they want to hear from us. They want to hear what God is doing in our lives. And so we believe that as we walk down that road together, we open up a place where we can not only accompany each other towards a more abundant life, but where we can hear from God through the lives of our partners. The second stone represents what we would call cultural humility. Just thinking about this perfect storm of U.S. culture, how unless we go in with our eyes wide open, we're going to end up stepping on people in ways that we don't want to and that aren't a good witness to the gospel. That's two stones. The third stone is what we would call bringing the fruits of development studies to bear on Christian mission. We've learned so much in the last 40 years, the 60 years, the experiences of the Peace Corps, U.S. Agency for International Development, so many Christian groups that are working in development. How can we bring those learnings to bear so that every congregational mission leader has access to them? Because you'll, issues, I mentioned the Rice Christian problem in China. Likewise, issues what development scholars today talk about sustainability. They're deeply concerned for, if we go down and do this mission this year, you're going to have a business person on your session who's going to say, okay, we did that last year. You're going to go do the same, you're going to go brush teeth again this year? Are we going to go and brush teeth every year? What's sustainable about that? Can we teach someone in the community? Can we help educate someone so that they can provide for help in dental care in that community? Let's think on the longer term. And I just want to note this in terms of changes in U.S. culture. You know, our grandparents and great-grandparents did this really, really well. They developed institutions. Of the four largest universities in the Middle East, three of them were founded by Presbyterian missionaries. Those to this day exist as monuments to people who were investing in a people who were not their own. And it's a beautiful function, it's a beautiful characteristic of Presbyterian mission over the years. Our forefathers and foremothers cared so deeply for folks that they would pour their lives into investing in the next generation. And so you see educational institutions, you see literacy programs, you see medical training programs. We trained in the Presbyterian Church, the Methodist Church, and the Catholic Church in the first half of the 20th century, trained more doctors and nurses than any other organizations in the world. You had, you know, international organizations working hard to do that. Universities and colleges did it. But we provided for more scholarships and sent more people to train from traditional birth attendants in villages in India to high-level physician specialists all over the world. That commitment to investing in future generations was a characteristic that we're losing now, because we're moving into that short-term focus. And we see that our own culture, it's like we're caught in an undertow and we're being carried out to sea. We're losing sight of the shore. And what this book is an invitation to is to think in terms of the long term, and how can we invest in ways that will glorify Jesus Christ in all aspects of life. Let me ask you this question. I've provided a lot of data and information, but what questions does this raise for you as you think about your own engagement in mission, how you invest in God's mission, how Westminster Presbyterian Church engages in mission, and how we as the Presbyterian Church? What questions does this raise? Did you hear something that surprised you, that challenged you, that encouraged you as we thought about the changes in mission today? Please.
How do you view all this applies to local mission to areas of deep poverty?
Thanks. And I was remiss in not including the local. I would say that everything we're talking about in terms of global mission applies. And by global, I mean local, national, and international. Because we get the same dynamics. I think Toxic Charity did a good job, Bob Lupton's book. He's a Presbyterian from Atlanta, and he wrote this book to point to the fact, he wrote his Toxic Charity to point to the fact that in local mission, we're really struggling in our approach to the community, and we're investing in non-sustainable ways that really just kind of make us feel good, but don't help the community involved. So I would say that local and international mission go hand in hand in this way, yeah. Yeah.
I haven't read very many books on this yet. Maybe we'll talk about this next week, but I'm curious about how I as an individual, but also how we as a church improve our literacy in that area.
Mm. Beautiful. And that's precisely what we'll look at next week. And I'll give you a hint. One of the signposts for us is together. I think we're in an age, the challenge to the internet, the challenge to the way we've developed our culture so individualistically, is that I go out on my lonesome, you know, me, myself, and I engage in mission. And if we were merely talking together, you as a friend, you might say, huh, you know, you've done that for 2 years in a row, Hunter. Have you thought about where you're going? What's your exit strategy? I never even thought about an exit strategy. Thank you for that, Bob. We're tending to do it by ourselves. And if even if you go to a mission fair or a mission network meeting, that we've got lots of, we've got 30-something mission networks in the Presbyterian Church, people come together and they try to get individuals to bring their resources out to their project. And so there's a lot of centrifugal force. Mission is actually pushing people away from each other rather than drawing them in. I would argue that we're not going to be able to change the world in the power of Jesus Christ unless we do it together. And so I think we really need to give some attention to what are the structures, the spaces where we can come together and engage in mission.
I'm going to repeat what you said in different ways.
Yeah.
To change the world, you have to change people.
Mm.
But the problem is people are more and more and more separate.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you get to the point where people are not so separate
mm.
to create unity?
Yeah.
You've
yeah.
used all these words.
Sure.
So you need unity, people working together
yeah.
to change the world.
Yeah.
How do we do that?
Yeah, and how do if world change requires people coming together, you need individual change and you need people coming together. What each of us can create a space. You can gather some people together by proposing, let's work on this together. People gather together and suddenly you've created a cell within that body of Christ that's working on that issue. There may be people around the world. How can we've got through the internet and technology, we can be connected with groups all over the world and engage in a collective impact that makes a real difference. But we've got to be talking to each other. So I don't want to give too much away from next week, but that's one of the areas that we'll be looking at in terms of some of the changes. Yeah, yeah. Good. We'll be looking next week at the opportunities that we have right at within reach to engage in mission more faithfully and effectively. And I'll look forward to doing that with you. Let's close in prayer if we could. God, we give you thanks for your presence, for your guidance of us on this day. We ask your blessing as we struggle with the challenges to mission as we engage in it. And we give you thanks because you open the door to us when we come with a spirit of humility and a willingness to work together. You bless that activity and help us to be part of what you're doing to change the world. We give you thanks in Christ's name. Amen. Thank you all.